Howdy, y'all. Welcome to Components. I'm Ren, product marketer at Heretto and your podcast MC.
I'm Patrick, CEO here at Heretto.
And I'm Jared, lead solutions consultant.
Thanks for joining us on our weekly conversation about componentized and structured content. Hope you enjoy this 15 or so minutes of fun talking about everything from data to innovations in AI.
All right, let's get into it.
Hi, welcome to Components. I'm Patrick Bozick, your host. And today I'm having a conversation with Loy Cyril. Welcome, Loy.
Thank you. Lovely to be here.
So today we're having another conversation about the content operations book. And you wrote chapter 8, which is on localization content operations, which is a really interesting chapter that, you know, I've had the chance to read a few times now, which is great. So before we jump into the content of your chapter, could you just give a little bit of background on who you are and maybe your professional background?
Sure, happy to. So I've been in, I've been in the content related industry since I go back to the 80s. So I'm not a spring chicken here. And started in the localization industry in the late 90s and kind of fell in love. And most of my career, I've either led localizations exclusively or localizations and content organizations. So led localizations at Intuit, at Workday, led language services and production at Google, was a content leader at JD Edwards, as well as a localization leader at JD Edwards, and kind of lots of other big enterprise type companies. That's kind of where I got my, I'd say most of my experience.
Wow. I didn't realize that you had been at Google. I knew about Workday. I knew about Intuit, but when was your stint at Google? Like, when was that?
2009 through 2012, 13, something like that.
Interesting. What parts of their localization content did you work on?
I led all of, well, when I started, I led European localization. Mm-hmm. So I led everything that wasn't led out of the U.S. So, and then we quickly kind of restructured because it didn't make much sense. So I ended up leading language services. So all of the languages, all of the products, everything that we did. And then I moved over and led the production side of the business. So pretty much every product that Google does, all the content, all the ad content, all of that good stuff from the language side to the production side.
Wow, that's fascinating. That must have been an absolute ton of work.
It was a ride. It was a ride. And this was early in the days of Google Translate. So we were doing, you know, retooling, retech. The product teams had their own notions on how to work. It was fun.
Wow, that must have been just a crazy time at Google. So before we get into the actual content of your chapter, I'd like to ask everybody who participated in the book and to tell the backstory of how you got involved.
Sure. So actually, I had been working with Kevin at Avenue CX. Oh. He was doing some work for us at Workday. So I knew Kevin, and Kevin said, hey, there's this project that I think they're looking at maybe introducing a localization chapter. Would you be interested in that? And I'm like, sure, I love content, love localization, happy to play. And so I think I was one of the last people. I think there were maybe one or two other people that popped on after me, but I think I came in after pretty much everybody had been going for quite a while.
I think you're the first person that we've talked to about their chapter whose story didn't somehow start with Carlos.
It did not start. He introduced me to Carlos. Kevin introduced me to Carlos. Yeah.
Oh, that's funny. Carlos is awesome, obviously. It's great that you got to come join the book and be a part of this project. It's been really good working with you on it. Okay. So I introduced your chapter by saying it's about localization and content operations. But do you want to give us a little bit more of a deeper background on what you wrote about?
Sure. I looked at my chapter as an opportunity to give content operation folks, more background on localizations. I think if you're working for a single language company and you're writing, you may not have that exposure. So the localization process meets the writerly process in a big way once you work for a global company. So my chapter is really focused on kind of an introduction. So there's a good grounding, a bit of background history on the industry and how it works and why it's different. There are some lovely synergies between localizations and content operations, but there are also some big differences. And then I kind of dig into a few areas that I think are interesting where you can make decisions in content, and it can either be fabulous for localizations or it can be problematic. So things like content reuse and structure and things like that.
Perfect. So I actually loved the background part of your chapter, which is kind of funny because typically, you know, this is kind of my domain and the background stuff, I kind of tend to skip over it because it's, you know, it's just something that I'm pretty familiar with. But in your chapter, you did both a great job explaining it, and some of it I found to be pretty fascinating. So before we get to the part that I really love the most, I do want to start by asking you to define the difference between translation, localization, globalization, and all those other really big words that everybody uses in the localization industry.
Happy to. And first of all, maybe I'll start out with, if you're not familiar with it, there are ISO codes for localization, translations, internationalization, globalization, even accessibility. And it all started many years ago because the word internationalization is just freaking long to write.
Yeah.
and lazy people and technology reasons conspired to shorten it. And so if you see the abbreviation of I-18N or L-10N, what that abbreviation basically is there are that many letters from the beginning of the word to the end of the word. So localization has 10 letters between the L and the final N. Internationalization has 18 letters between the I and the final N. So that's the inside wonky thing that our industry does all over the place. But each one of those has a different meaning. So I'll start with translation. It's the easy one. It's the only one that nobody ever needs to really have explained to them. Translation is basically taking something from a source language into a target language and preserving the meaning, the intent of that source language. It is not a literal translation. You may get that from a Google Translate. You may also get something a little bit better from a Google Translate these days. The localization is often treated somewhat synonymously with translation for the folks that don't really know the difference. But the key difference is localization has two things going for it that translation doesn't. Translation is just focused on turning one language into another. Localization is also focused on making it right for a locale or a specific domain. So if you're translating, say, into Canadian French that's appropriate for Quebec, that might be quite different than if you're translating for, let's say, Quebec in the medical industry versus Quebec in the retail industry. So it's a language. You're translating into Canadian French, but you're making it specific to an industry or to a specific locale. Another example might be you might be translating into French, and you might be very concerned about a certain area in France, but less so another area in France. You're actually thinking about the geography. You're thinking about the unique location or locale. It's just more specific. The other thing that localization also includes is the process and the technology. So whenever somebody's talking about localization, they're not just talking about making it right for a specific locale and translating it. That's all part of it. They're also usually talking about the process and the tools and the tech. That's kind of bundled in because that's a huge part of what the industry is about. Now, internationalization is actually making like software code or website, making the code work for a multilingual global type product. So when you're internationalizing a product, you're doing things like making certain that it's smart enough to know that date formats are different in different countries, or that currency is different in different countries. So, or that language is different, and so that you can pull out the text and actually translate that language. So internationalization is basically developer's work. It's technical work. It's generally a strong partnership between a localization team and an engineering team to get it right. And that is work that writers usually are not as much engaged in, but engineers are. And then the last one in the bunch is globalization. And globalization can be a bit of a catch-all. So it kind of can have a couple different meanings. At the highest level, globalization is almost the opposite of localization. To localize something means to make it right locally. To globalize something means to make it work globally. So an example might be, I've localized my product so that it does a specific local tax, and I've translated it so that works in, you know, in Munich. That's a localization. But I've enabled my product to manage multi-currency, so I can handle all currency all around the world. That's a globalization. So a globalization is kind of the higher order. When you design your products, you think about designing a global product. When you write, if you write with globalization in mind, you will have an easier time than digging down into doing the localizations. If you don't write with global in mind, you'll undo a lot of good English, basically. Because in fact, English, when you're writing in English and you're writing for the States, you are in fact doing a localization from a writerly standpoint. So that's
there's a lot in there.
Yeah. The last thing I'll say about globalization is when you're super lazy and you can't think of the biggest, broadest word to cover all of these different aspects of making products and content global, globalization becomes the catch-all. So like teams that include lots of different functions might be called a globalization team because they might have internationalization, they might have localization, they might have translators, they might have testing, they might have a lot of other functions. Globalization is the catch-all. So yeah,
Is it fair to think of internationalization as being like the product work and localization as the content work? Is that a good line?
Internationalization is the product work. So that is fair. But from a localization standpoint, it's all content. Okay. We see product as content. We see,
that's fair.
You know,
that's
help as we see all things as content. So that is kind of a difference in that we view all of it as content at some level.
The first thing I saw in my mind when you talked about the product side of internationalization is the ability to put the steering wheel on the other side of the car when you're selling into like Britain or or Japan.
And
that's internationalization, right?
No, yeah. That is true product localization.
Oh, interesting.
But that is not the same as translation, although there's, you know, there may be language in there as well. No, that is truly, and in order to do that well, an auto designer actually has to design globally so that it'll work whether they move the steering wheel and those controls or not. So they're designing from a global standpoint, so that they can do something that's very locally specific in the, you know, in certain countries where the steering wheel and the other controls move.
And I love that example, one, because we've all sat in a car. So it's really easy to picture, but there's also this aspect that you think about the inception of a car all the way to the point where somebody is driving it. And I think it's a good visual for how far back in a process, localization, globalization, internationalization, term I should be using exactly there, which I'm sure you'll correct me on several times throughout this conversation. But whichever one of those you should be using, it's years behind the final product that gets deployed to the customer. And I think that's probably more true for more products than most people realize.
It is. The more you think, the way that I would think about this is, if you will ever go global, if your product ever has a reason to be used outside of the country and used someplace else, you should be planning for it early, because the decisions and the changes you'll make will be way more, it's just like fixing a bug, way more expensive downstream. And then once you fix it downstream, you still have to go upstream to make a workable process. So the biggest excuse most tech companies have is like, this product's not going global yet, which means they're going to lay a lot of concrete that they're going to have to dig up later. You might as well lay down a good structure that you can build on rather than, you know, creating something you're just going to spend a lot of money on tech debt fixing downstream.
I'm sure that that happens the vast majority of the time because I've seen it.
American companies, we don't think global out of the box.
And it's incredible that it isn't more drag, that these companies are still able to like get out ahead of it and fix it. But think about the money they waste in the process.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's costly to go back and redo. And it takes a lot of time. It can take an engineering team multiple releases to go back and refactor their code so it will actually work around the world. And can still be kludgy if they didn't think through, you know, the deep levels of architecture that need to work globally. So, yeah, that's why people like me get jobs.
Well, I think we're all of us have pretty safe employment when it comes to this stuff, because the world's not going to become less global anytime soon. So the next part of your kind of background is actually a discussion on how the actual industry works. So you go through and you spend a whole section describing the fundamentals of how the industry works. And I found this to be really fascinating. You know, obviously I've worked in this, the content side of this industry for a couple of decades now, but even I was kind of surprised by how some of these relationships work and like move in today's world. So could you just give us the kind of background on, you know, the whole dark side of the translation industry, like what's going on there when you send the package off for translation, like how does all that work?
What's all the magic behind the scenes? So probably the first thing I'll say about the translation localization industry is it is largely an outsourced industry. And it's logical, it makes sense when you consider you're translating into lots of different languages. Well, those people are in their own country, sitting in their own house, doing their own work in their country around the world. So so unlike technical writing and content operations, where you will have typically a large team and they might be employed, there are still contract resources in that industry, but it's a smaller subset. It tends to be more job-based, whereas the localization industry is freelancers. There's gazillions of freelancers out there, and those freelancers can be employed by either single language vendors or regional vendors. And these are usually small, almost kind of mom and pop type translation agencies. And then there are multi-language vendors who are the big guys. So these are, you know, the Lionbridges, the RWS, you know, there's a handful of the bigger players in the industry. Those big players employ single language vendors, they employ regional language vendors, and in some cases, they even employ freelancers. The single language vendors employ generally just freelancers. And so the industry is also super incestuous. So somebody who's doing translation work might work for a few different vendors. They could work for three different vendors. They could potentially see the same work coming to them from different vendors. And they're often in a position where they could choose, well, which one's going to pay me better?
Wow, really?
Yeah.
So they may see the same job come through.
They may see that.
Wow.
You know, I see that, you know, I've been, usually it's not the same job, but it's usually the work from the same client that's of the same nature. And so it's not at all atypical to, you know, to have that kind of incestuousness going on in the industry. It's also, it means it's a really small world. Like kind of everybody knows everybody. Super small. It's a big industry, but it's a super small world where everybody knows everybody. So something that goes south, lots of people hear about. And reputation, you know, the reputation really matters in this industry because it's tight.
Yeah, that's very similar to the content industry. And I think the content industry is probably a little bit smaller just because there's less freelance going on. But it is an everybody knows everybody industry, which I personally like.
I do too. Yeah.
So I have this picture of this, you know, all of these people all over the world doing all this translation work. And I'm just curious, like, if you had to guess, what percentage of the words that are translated for the end user are actually translated by people at this point in time?
Okay. So this has changed a lot in recent years. For as long as I've been in the localization industry, machine translations were up and coming. In the last 10 years, machine translations came. I mean, they really finally got to a level of true useful maturity. And we've been working with machine translations in the industry for some time, and we've seen it go from statistical to neural. And now we're looking at all the fun Gen AI stuff and what that's going to do in our industry. But if I go back in time to when I began in the industry, humans translated all of the tech pubs, all the help, all the manuals, all that content. If I think about today, that is the kind of content that is almost always a target for machine translations. And then there may be in many cases, if content's used heavily, then that content will also be post-edited by a human. So somebody will come along and also review it, make certain that the machine translations didn't do some bizarre random thing, because they can occasionally do bizarre random things. But things like marketing content, or think about like a children's book. A children's book is never going to be probably machine translation. You know, the kind of nuance and cleverness of that kind of creative work typically requires a much tighter human in the loop. Even if a machine translation offers a suggestion, you will still have a human making certain that that suggestion is good. I'd say most of us, most everybody in the localization industry uses machine translation as part of our process.
So you think that the industry for hard content, so like technical content, that's, you know, 90%+ machine translation at this point in time?
It's machine translation with humans typically in the loop. So typically reviewing it or post-editing it. And that will depend upon the nature of that content. Like if it's Boeing and it's aerospace and people can die if there's a mistake, or it's medical and people can die if there's a mistake, that stuff might get machine translated to speed up the process or provide suggestions. But a human, I assure you, is in the loop. Reviewing, like that stuff gets more than a post-edit. It gets a deep human review. But if you have content that's out on the web that may or may not get very much use, that content is typically good candidate content for machine translation that may only get human reviewed based upon how much it is being consumed. So there's a spectrum of like content that's barely looked at, to content that's occasionally seen, to content that is, you know, important to life and livelihood, and people could die. So that spectrum is pretty much where you see humans play, similar to kind of the level of effort on the content side.
So do you think that spectrum changes substantially at this point? You think it's a thing where as the technologies get better, even in those life and death situations, we start to like pull humans back more than we already have? Or do you think it's kind of reached a point of maturity?
I think everything is in an interesting space right now because of all the generative AI tech that's out there. Like the impact that that has on the content world and on the localization world will be interesting to watch over the next few years. I mean, my belief is that there will always be a reason for humans in the loop because language is constantly changing. And because it's constantly changing and it's very organic in nature, humans are the ones that are messing with it, right? You'll always have a need for some humans in that loop to understand what the latest jargon that some 14-year-old thought of that's suddenly gone viral and now everybody's using it, right? So language does that. So I think there will always be a reason for humans. I think the big difference, as I view it, is in the past it was all human work. It was all craft. Mm-hmm. Now there's much more scale in it, and the craft work is oftentimes finishing work, or it's for the higher value content, the content that is perceived as most valuable, most important, most strategic, most influential, or most likely to, you know, create risk. And so I think that what we'll see is what we've seen in my career time in the industry is we used to translate this much stuff, just like, I'm like holding my fingers up like an inch. We translated an inch worth of stuff in the past, and now we're translating, you know, a mile worth of stuff today. Well, you don't do that with the same people, with the same number of resources. So you do that by changing your process. And instead of having humans do that, you know, that inch worth of perfect work, you have humans doing the review and the evaluation. I think about it as if it's craft and you start out with, you know, hand knit or hand tatting, but then you actually need to mass produce this, you get to a place where the mass production will never be as amazing as that handwork. But it will be more reliable and you can do a whole lot more of it, but you'll still need somebody in there checking and making certain something terrible didn't happen along the way and checking the process and spot checking it. That's kind of the world we've moved into. We've gone from craft to scale, and craft is introduced more as post-processing or pre-processing work that you can do to ensure better outcomes at the end.
Yeah, that fits with the content operations book, obviously, in that the entire purpose of content operations is to scale up. It's to increase production with the same number of human resources. And it sounds like what you see is the future in translation is more of that as well. And, you know, maybe we're going from a mile to 10 miles to, you know, everything we can possibly translate, but still same number of people.
Yeah, I that's really what I've seen happen in the industry with machine translations. And I think it's just going to be the next level of scale when we think about generative AI. And the nature of that is it's going to be more of a free-for-all. So in the past, we had a very controlled process. So things came through controlled process. When you give everybody the tools, you just get a hot mess out there. And then they start to realize they have a hot mess, and then they want to get in the process. So I think we'll be seeing that on the content side as well as on the language side.